This audio is from Radio New Zealand. To find out more, visit radionz.co.nz.
I'm Tressa Dunworth, an international lawyer working in the Faculty of Law, the University of Auckland, and I'm pleased to be chairing this session of the 2010 Auckland Writers and Readers Festival, speaking with Anthony Lowenstein about his book, My Israel Question. The debate at the heart of his book and much of Anthony's work that we're going to be talking about today is encapsulated in the US press last month in an exchange which took place. On the one hand, the exchange was Eli Wiesel, a Nobel laureate and Holocaust survivor. He wrote an open letter to Barack Obama about the Jewish settlement construction ongoing in Jerusalem, and he lives in the United States. On the other side of the exchange, there was a group of about 100 Jewish academics and political activists who were living in Jerusalem. Wiesel, calling on Barack Obama to stop pressuring Israel regarding the settlement in Jerusalem, said this: "The first song I heard was my mother's lullaby about and for Jerusalem. Its sadness and its joy are part of our collective memory." In their response, the Jerusalemites in the New York Review of Books said, "We cannot recognize our city in the sentimental abstraction you call by its name. Your Jerusalem is an ideal, an object of prayers and a bearer of the collective memory of a people whose members actually bear many individual memories." In this exchange, which took place just last month, we see all the themes of Anthony's work drawn together: Jewish identity, the role of the media, Israel's past, and perhaps most importantly, Israel's future. It is therefore a great pleasure for me to welcome today the author of My Israel Question. Anthony is a freelance journalist, author, blogger, and political activist. Self-described as an atheist Jewish Australian, he lives in Sydney and has written for Australian and international newspapers and many other publications. In addition to his book, My Israel Question, now in its third edition, Anthony has published The Blogging Revolution in 2008 and contributed to A Time to Speak Out, a book about the rise of global Jewish dissent, and Not Happy John in 2004 on the controversy over the award of the Sydney Peace Prize to Hanan Ashrawi. Please join with me in welcoming Anthony. I was very struck in your book with the criticisms you have about much of the mainstream media, and in particular you talk about the fact that they are not often living up to their role of objective commentators.
Fairness in journalism is important, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you give two equal sides to two different perspectives. If you spend any time in the West Bank or Gaza, which is under occupation by Israel and has been for decades, what you see is a clear, profound disparity of power. And therefore, I guess I've decided that I felt that it was important in Australia and indeed in the diaspora as well to have different Jewish perspectives and different Jewish voices. I mean, I'm an atheist, as you said before. I don't practice my religion in any way. I'm proud of being Jewish. There's a dissenting a tradition and history of Jews who don't accept, so to speak, what is the majority think. And unfortunately, since the Holocaust, when it comes to Israel, there is very little Jewish dissent on this issue. It exists, it's growing, and something which I am very encouraged by. But certainly in many Western states, all we really hear are the same Jewish voices, which pretty much say Israel can do basically what it wants. They'll always side with Israel because that's what you should do as a good Jew. And if you have criticism, keep it to yourself, because the community, Israel, can't handle debate, implying somehow that Israel is a house of cards, which is a nonsense. Israel is has a fifth biggest army in the world, has 200 nuclear weapons, it's backed by a superpower. Hello. The truth is Israel is a very powerful state which has issues to deal with, and I'm not suggesting there's no hatred towards Israel. There has been. There is hatred in the Middle East. Anti-Semitism exists. It's real. But the truth is that And this is even a view that's increasingly accepted by the US State Department and the Pentagon, believe it or not, by David Petraeus, who gave a testimony to Congress a few months ago, essentially saying the way in which the US has for decades sided so wholeheartedly with only one side is actually affecting the ability for America to achieve its foreign policy goals. Now, here, of course, that means winning in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, that's not what I would see as a sign of success. But the point that he's making, I think, is an important one. There's a growing shift to say, to be a good Jew is not to simply be uncritical.
It seems to me, I mean, it was a theme that came out very clearly in your book, and, you know, on the back cover they talk about you're described as a self-hating Jew.
And that's one of the kinder comments.
One of the kinder comments. Yeah. Possibly that's a distraction and you oughtn't to even answer it, because surely the idea is that we have a right to comment because or hold a view or become informed on the basis of our shared humanity. Can I only comment on Ireland? Can you only comment on Australia?
No. I mean, this is a simple answer to that, but the slightly longer version is that there's no doubt that that's an attempt to silence. And many Jews and Israelis say the same thing. We haven't got a right to meddle with internal Israeli politics. Well, my response to that is always very, very clear. The West has every right to meddle in that country because we basically pay for its existence. You have every right to ask why your government is supporting apartheid in Palestine. That's a legitimate question to ask, a very legitimate question. And the truth is that that question is rarely asked without it being accompanied by a great deal of fire and brimstone and anger with even having the debate. Many people are so petrified of speaking out about this issue because if they say something, they're worried they're going to be accused of either anti-Semitism by their friends, by colleagues, by other people. That's the non-Jews. And the Jewish people often are very concerned. Even if they have some concern, they sort of see a report about Palestine and they think the Gaza conflict recently was maybe didn't quite feel right to them. If they say something to their Jewish friends, family, partner, they'll be given the cold shoulder, and that happens in very profound ways. And people often approach me and say things like, if I say this sort of thing to my wife, my marriage will be over. That sounds extreme and crazy. There is this internalized silencing that has gone on since 1967. And the result of that has been, for at least 40 years, and arguably for over 60, a situation where Israel has been allowed to occupy another people's land and commit unbelievably hideous human rights abuses in the name of Judaism. Mm. And if history is any guide, it's going to be very, very clear, like with apartheid South Africa, who actually spoke out before this regime fell and who didn't. And it's very, very clear that the majority of white South Africans didn't say a word because life was good. It was very, very good. People don't give up privilege by choice. They give it up because they either presume that somehow life could be better or more equal with a change, or the world says, you guys have a choice, you either stay as you are or you shift, and Israel is not at that stage yet. But I would argue that in our lifetime, fingers crossed, we will be.
I'm remembering here the old lady from the United States in your documentary, A Different Kind of Jew, This American woman who was a Holocaust survivor as a child, I think, and she talked about how she had emigrated to the United States shortly after the Second World War and had lived her life peacefully, and only, it seems to me, in her 60s had become aware of the truth about Israel, we might say. And, I mean, I guess I have two questions arising out of that. First of all, how can this silencing happen? And second of all, I think that it might be breaking down now, or what are your views on that?
Let me answer the second part first. There are shifts, there's no doubt about that. And I think the reason for that is a fewfold, and I'll briefly explain. The Gaza conflict in late 08, 09 did change things, mainly because the average person who actually read more than what the mainstream press told them, which was going to be a war between Israel and Hamas. It wasn't a war, it was a massacre. I mean, there basically was no war. A war suggests there were two sides who were fighting. Hamas didn't really fight in that war. I'm not saying they should have, but they didn't. It was an onslaught and a massacre, and 1,400 Palestinians were killed, the vast majority of whom were civilians, and 13 Israeli killed, many of whom were killed by friendly fire. What's, I think, interesting about this is that for many Jews in America, including some of the most prominent Jewish bloggers, and we're talking about Jewish bloggers who are high profile, massive readership, mainly on the left, came out and said, we're Jewish, but this war is insane. It's not going to achieve anything Israel wants it to achieve. These were mainly younger Jews, Jews in their 20s, 30s and 40s. And there was a study that came out last year through the University of Chicago, which interviewed 1,500 young Jews between 18 and 35. A third of those Jews said they would not care if Israel no longer existed as a Jewish state. And those figures caused shockwaves to the American Jewish community. You know, my God, Israel, you know, what happens to the Israel in 20 years, 30 years, 50 years? And the shifts that are happening is twofold. Firstly, because intermarriage is going through the roof in the States particularly, and many Jews simply are less interested in being obsessed with kind of a ethnic affiliation with Israel because we're Jewish. And secondly, even Jews who may stay within their community, so to speak, are increasingly uncomfortable with the default blind support they see their parents, grandparents and older members of the community giving to Israel. And they also don't want to be known, if they speak about this, as a country that occupies. That's what Israel does. It's an occupying country. We often hear Israel is a democracy in the Middle East. Israel's not a democracy if you're not Jewish. It's a wonderful democracy if you are Jewish, and that's great. And people say, well, isn't it better than Iran? Well, yes. Is that the comparison we're dealing with here? Yes. Iran is a dictatorship, and I spent time there, and it's getting worse, sadly. So is Egypt. So is Jordan. And let's not forget that America supports Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan to the tune of billions of dollars every year. Israel's the highest recipient of US aid. It receives $3 billion to $6 billion annually. I think the second point about the silencing, why does it happen? It's a complex question, and it's hard to answer. I think it's partly because there is undoubtedly an insecurity amongst a lot of the Jewish diaspora. There's an insecurity about the fact that if we're too critical, if Israel has already got so many enemies, why does it need more?
Well, just in terms of your own family experience, if I can encroach into that, I wanted to peek in the curtains of when you were in Israel with, I'm not sure if it was an aunt or some cousins, but you visited some family. How was that? What did you talk about over the dinner table?
Well, a lot. It was very heated. I wouldn't say the conversation ran out. It certainly didn't. I was there in 2005 and I spent time in the West Bank. I was researching my Israel question. I went to Israel proper and they lived just outside Tel Aviv. This cousin has always been a lunatic, but nonetheless, I wanted to go there and see him because I was interested in hearing what him and his family said. And what struck me was the blatant racism. It wasn't hidden. It was proud. There was no occupation in his mind. It wasn't an occupation. It was just a sort of a dispute that would get agreed about maybe one day. He wasn't a fundamentalist Jew by any means. And a lot of people like him in Israel, I mean, the studies increasingly show this, that there's a real brand of nationalism, a racist nationalism that's going on in Israel at the moment. It's been growing for years. It's always existed, but it's becoming more and more mainstream. It doesn't matter who's been in power in that country. Yeah. The occupation has deepened. As I said, during the 90s, it was run by the so-called lefties, and the occupation, in fact, doubled more than it had under Likud, under the conservative side. Israel is not some wonderful country where debate is happening freely. You're not going to be killed by simply speaking out. You won't. But the truth is that in Israel, increasingly, there is it's more than an intolerance. There is I'm going to give you an example. A study came out 2 weeks ago for Tel Aviv University, finding that the majority of Israeli Jews, were very happy with the idea of any human rights group that speaks out against Israel should be banned. Banned. Now, a lot of people might sort of not like what these groups are saying, but they wouldn't maybe say they should be banned. Yeah. And that is a mindset that is quite common. I'm not saying all Israeli Jews, many are not like that, but any kind of real peace movement in that country is virtually non-existent. It's dead. It has no power. So this, I think, is why for many people in diaspora, there is very much a belief that change will not come from within. It won't.
As a journalist, why is it, do you think, that we have so little real debate? So, for example, this day last week, the Israeli ambassador's credentials were presented to our Governor General. Yeah. There was some little snapshots of that happening. There was some protesters in Wellington. But nobody took the opportunity, nobody in the media took the opportunity to say, well, let's just reflect on this for a moment and let's reflect on the sort of warmer relationships that there seems to be now between New Zealand and Israel. Nobody is talking about it. Why is that?
I think there is and Australia is very similar in this way. The relationship is not really one of equality. It's one of convenience in many ways. Trade is part of it. US alliance is a big part of it. The only reason that, for example, New Zealand or Australia has troops in Afghanistan is because of the alliance. Something, you know, US alliance. That's the only reason Australia and New Zealand are there. There's no other reason. Any other reason that's given is a lie. I mean, we know it's because, you know, it's very hard for a lot of governments to say no when Washington comes knocking. I often think in some ways that Fox News is more honest than many others. They proudly say what they stand for. They're conservative, they're right-wing, they think Obama's the devil. You know what you're getting. It's very clear. The CNNs and the MSNBCs, and that's in America, and Australia, the Sydney Morning Herald or the New York Times, they either give the impression of being balanced, fair, and the record on Israel-Palestine, say, or even on Iraq and Afghanistan on these issues is shameful. I mean, let's not forget the New York Times supported the Iraq war. They are now publishing regular articles saying how Iran is a great threat, and all through anonymous sourcing, of course, which is US government backing. They learn nothing. Nothing has changed.
What has broken down in the theory of... Because the media is central to a functioning democracy where we put pressure on our government to change its policy.
Well, do we?
Well, we don't.
Well,
but
we don't.
I'm not saying that, you know, I don't want to say, well, if we had only known, because the information is there to get it. But you actually have to make an effort to get the information.
Yes, but it's far easier now than it was, say, 10 years ago. So it's less of an excuse. Why does the mainstream media ignore certain views? Well, I think there's a few reasons. One, many journalists don't see themselves as journalists. They see themselves that they're players. They want to be players. And being a player means you want to be close to power. They choose what kind of position and they want to be in. Do they want to be the kind of journalist that never gets that kind of wonderful scoop from an advisor of a politician? Do they want to be the kind of person who doesn't get those kind of phone calls the night before with the great story?
Or was that Sean Plunkett said in the session earlier today where he didn't get invited?
Didn't get invited to Afghanistan. What a shame that was for him, I'm sure. But most journalists are happy to be in that kind of role. They're players. There's a very cozy relationship in many Western countries, including Australia, America, and I'm presuming here too, between journalists and politicians. They often, I'm not saying they're always socialising together, but there's far too much, in my view, interaction about that. Most of the scoops that you read in most of the mainstream press are not scoops, they're basically sanctioned leaks. Some advisor or some politician gives a friendly journalist some information. When it comes to Israel-Palestine, there's two problems. Firstly, there's profound self-censoring. Many, many journalists and editors will say, if we run a story, say, about Israel from a critical perspective, we're going to be bombarded with crap. The Jewish community, the Zionist lobby will hammer us, and it's not often worth the pain that's going to come with that. So often that's part of it. There has been, I think, a historical sympathy for Israel. And I think that's become worse because the linkage that many Zionists made about the Israel war against terror, so to speak, has been in fact quite effective on the one hand because, the day after 9/11, there's a great infamous interview that Netanyahu made to American media, and he was asked what he thought about the events the day before. And he said, I thought it was pretty good actually, pretty important. And he said, what do you mean? Why is that good? And his response, and I'm paraphrasing, was, now America and the West knows what we've been going through. We've been fighting terror, these lunatics, for years. Now you guys know what it's like. Now, the myth, of course, we have now is that Obama's coming, and there's movement on the peace process. Well, the truth is on the ground over there. Nothing has changed.
Let me ask you a question then about Israel as opposed to the media and journalists and Jewish identity. I haven't read the first and second edition of the book, only the third edition.
You're really sure? Very good.
But I understand from the third edition that you had somewhat of a, maybe change of heart is overstating it, but that you further refined your thoughts between them. And one major difference between the first and the third editions are your shift in thinking from a two-state solution to a one-state solution. Yes. Do you want to maybe?
Sure. The so-called peace process since the Oslo period in the 90s has been pushing a supposed two-state solution. When I went to Israel a few years ago in 2005, I spoke to a lot of commentators, Israelis and Palestinians, and some talked about a one-state solution. For those who don't know what that means, let me briefly explain. A one-state solution would be, of course, a state where everyone lives together. There needs to be obviously safe legal and political safeguards against the minority population, which at the moment would be Palestinian, but we don't know exactly when, 5, 10, 15 years, Jews are going to be the minority. So therefore, Israel really has a choice. and the Jewish diaspora, Zionism has a choice. There are really only three options. One option is the maintenance of the status quo, which is essentially apartheid indefinitely, which is what's happening now. Second option is some kind of amazing intervention by Saint Obama to bring two states, which won't happen. And the third option is a one-state solution. And that won't happen tomorrow either. It may happen in a de facto way. And I mentioned this, my change of heart partly came through speaking to many more people, seeing two things. Firstly, the lack of viability of a two-state solution. How is it going to happen? Where is it going to happen? This is putting aside the moral question. Yep. On a practical sense, how is this going to... I mean, where? One goes there, one sees the maps. What Israel has done brilliantly from its perspective is create so many facts on the ground now. There are now 500,000 Jewish settlers, all there illegally. No international law supports anyone with those people being there. So that's the reality. And secondly, there is no evidence, in fact, in any Israeli Jewish society of any kind of real political or even civil move to actually bring about what a two-state solution would have to look like. There's no evidence for that. Now, the only way a one-state solution would happen, as I said, and I fear this is the only likely outcome, is by default, where we sort of stumble along indefinitely with the occupation. It kind of continues. There's some sham of a peace process. Doesn't really go anywhere. We fast forward 5-10 years and Jews are the minority. That is what's happening now. And I don't see any reason why that's going to really change. And I think on a moral question, the issue of a two-state solution is very problematic because you have 20% of Israelis are Arabs who live in Israel proper. And the idea, frankly, of forcing them to accept the concept of a Jewish Zionist state is fundamentally anti-democratic. I mean, even now, when people say that Israeli Arabs have full equal rights, yes, they can vote. There have been some Supreme Court judges who are Arabs, and then everyone goes, well, that's great. Well, it is great. I mean, look at actually where the money from the Israeli state has gone. Education, health, far, far, far less in Arab areas. And there's greater restriction of movement from Israeli Arabs than if you're Israeli Jewish. So all those reasons, amongst others, contribute to a change in my position. And just last week, let me finish on this. John Mearsheimer, who's one of the co-authors of the book The Israel Lobby, which essentially critiques the role of America's relationship with the Jewish state, he's a conservative guy. He's hardly some crazy radical, and he's always supported two states. He gave a very important speech at the Palestine Center in D.C. 2 weeks ago in Washington and said, essentially, that the two-state solution is dead, not because he doesn't think it's not good, but because there is zero evidence that suggests we're moving in the direction to make it happen. Many Jews, their response is automatically, well, that's the end of the Jewish state. And that's a red line. We can't go there. It gets people very upset. How could you say that? You're Jewish, et cetera, et cetera. And my response is, my loyalty is not to just Jews because I'm Jewish. It's to say, what's the most just outcome for all peoples? And if you can see on the ground, the facts are so clearly saying that Israel is driving itself off a cliff by occupying people continuously, causing unbelievable human rights abuses. There is no solution to simply talk about, simply saying two states doesn't make it happen anymore.
Let's talk about the states in the region. Put that into the mix of, are we going to look at a one state or a two state solution or no solution?
The way, again, we get framed in the media is that it's essentially Iran versus the rest of the Middle East, that the non-democratic Arab states are petrified of Iran. They're happy to work with Israel to fight the common enemy, which is Tehran. And there's no doubt that the fear that many of us have is in the next years there could well be a military strike against Iran by America or Israel, which with, of course, American backing and support. Wouldn't happen without it. And certainly, publicly, the Arab states would be opposed. Privately, they'd be wrapped. And let's not forget that the Arab states, putting aside Syria and obviously Iran, they're client states. There's amazing continuity between Bush and Obama on most of these key issues. People often, in the wonderful mainstream press, print article after article about the change we've seen. Where's the change? You go to any country in the Middle East, nothing has changed. Nothing.
Okay. I've lots of other questions, but I am conscious that we have quite a big audience. So what I'll do now, I think, is open the floor for some questions and I'll see if I'm rude enough to butt in with my own. So can we have an indication of hands, please? Yep.
Anthony, you just said that it is de facto that the two-state solution is dead. But I think we all know that the Palestinian Authority, and especially the Palestinian Prime Minister, Fayyad, has said in the last few weeks and months publicly that the Palestinians will declare a state of their own next to Israel by next year, 2011. And I think that's what the West, and especially America, would want. And I think also Israel would approve of that, because that will stop this threat of the Jews within Israel today becoming a minority. The Palestinians will have a state, and Israel will continue to live within certain boundaries. What are your comments on that?
How do you declare a state under occupation? The question is it viable, and is it supported by anybody? I would suggest that the majority of Palestinians, even if they say they think they could be better than where they are now, will soon realize that they are basically being set up to have a Bantustan state. That's not a state. That's little cantons of areas that still have to go via tunnels, which is what is being built now. Tunnels that go under Israeli settlements to go between towns. That's what a Palestinian state's going to look like. I think it's insane.
Anthony, could you explain what you mean as the difference between Judaism and Zionism?
A Zionist is someone who believes in Jews to a Jewish homeland, to the right of Jews to settle. I mean, it didn't always have to be Palestine. Ironically, when there was talk about Israel forming, there was investigations in other parts of the world, what is now Kenya, what is now Tasmania and Australia, weirdly enough, Argentina. It is obviously in Palestine. The conflation, the deliberate conflation between Judaism and Zionism has been made for decades by many Jews. Many would argue that you can't be an anti-Zionist Jew. It's simply impossible. You're not Jewish anymore. And more importantly, that if you are critical of Israel, you must be anti-Semitic. Anyone in this audience who's not Jewish, I suspect, will know that if they say certain things, even mildly critical, anything I've said tonight to your Jewish friends, I suspect most of them will say to you, if you have the guts to say it in the first place, you're anti-Semitic. It's this knee-jerk, unthinking, anti-intellectual. And this, to me, is what Judaism has become. Judaism basically has become a slave to essentially what Israel is doing. I spend a lot of time speaking to Muslim groups in Australia, in America, and also in the Middle East, obviously, that for many Muslim people, they've never met a Jew who's not a Zionist. I'll give you a very quick example about this. If last year I was in Aceh, which is in Indonesia, on a speaking tour, believe it or not, and I did a lot of events there, and of course everyone there is a Muslim. And speaking about Israel-Palestine from an anti-Zionist perspective, for most people there was so incomprehensible initially. The idea that someone Jewish would say what I'm saying was a bit of a shock, but it was a pleasant shock very quickly. And at the end of it, someone said to me, many of us can like Jews again. There is anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. It's real. I've seen it. I've written about it. There's no excuse for that. However, a blind person knows that it often is directly related and connected to what Israel is doing. I mean, for anyone to say that anti-Semitism is not caused by Israel in part is insane. It's like saying anti-Americanism wasn't caused by the Iraq War. There's a direct correlation there, and people who deny that, I think, are denying reality.
From an outsider's perspective, not being Jewish, it seems to me that Jews or Israeli can't talk about what is happening with the state in Palestine, because it's what happened to them in the Holocaust. They're perpetrating the same crime that was committed against them.
I don't personally make that comparison. There are undoubted similarities, not in terms of numbers killed, that goes without saying, but certainly the dehumanisation of the other is happening. I think many people in the West choose to look away from that, when the truth is, if one reads, as I do regularly, the Israeli press, the right-wing press, read how they describe the Arabs. And you change the word Arab for Jew, it's unbelievably similar. Again, I'm not suggesting that Israel is Nazi Germany. It's not. I don't make that comparison, and often I'm criticised for not making that comparison. But I choose not to for reasons, because I think it's A, not really historically accurate, and B, I don't think it's... Every situation is different. But one thing I think that is very clear is that for many, many Jews, and it's often written in a very obvious way, it's not hidden, they sort of say, particularly Zionists in the diaspora, but in Israel as well, we've always been screwed historically, always have been. Holocaust was a culmination. And now we have a state and we're strong, so screw you.
The idea of Israel, not the concept, but the physical idea of Israel, is central to many Jews who aren't in favour of abuses against people, other people.
Sure. That can easily, though, be used as an excuse to turn away from actually what is going on. Israel is not an abstract idea. It's a real country. It's there. It's doing a lot of these things in our name, so to speak, as Jews. I mean, if one believes that Israel has the right to exist as a Jewish state, even if one accepts that concept, you can't accept it and say that it's a democracy when it abuses another people. We support Israel because we have shared values. Where is the shared values in occupation? My point is that increasingly Israel cannot thrive and survive without Western support. It will not exist. It will not exist. And if people in the diaspora, Jews particularly, continue to turn away from that and say, well, settlements are bad, but we support Israel anyway, I would argue, and again, it's not directed at you, please don't take it as such, that's not good enough anymore. The argument of saying we've had decades and decades and decades of a policy that's continued to get worse. Occupations only got worse in 40 years. There is no change in any instance of that getting any better anytime soon. So one either puts actual real pressure on Israel to change, or one simply believes in an idealistic concept but doesn't exist. Israel is a country that occupies other people. And I think Israel is starting to realise increasingly that in terms of Western public opinion, Israel's lost. It's gone. If you look at the BBC did a poll last month, 30,000 people in 27 countries around the world. And the least favourite countries were Iran, Pakistan, Israel, and the one I forget. Now, that doesn't in itself mean Israel's a bad state because the world says it is. That's not my point. My point is that decades and decades and decades of occupation have harmed and soiled Jewish identity so badly, and there is no accountability for that. Where are the discussions? Where are the debates? The policy of separation and isolation of Palestinians in the West Bank, putting Gaza aside for a second, is worse than what blacks suffered in South Africa. Worse. There is undoubtedly some dissent in Israel. There is. But I think often the mistake that many people make outside of Israel is there's a thriving debate. One reads, as I do, the Israeli press every day, and you'd be amazed how much consensus there is. Haaretz, as some of you may have heard of, is one of the leading liberal papers over there. It's read by about 4 people in Israel. It's read massively overseas, but no one reads in Israel. I mean, I'm generalising. The mainstream 3 major newspapers in Israel, the 3 major TV stations in Israel, their positions are very clear. They essentially support occupation. You cannot talk about civil society in a vacuum. In the last 6-12 months alone, Israel is arresting countless Arab civil society members simply for the crime of speaking out. Administrative detention, it's called. You can hold someone in Israel for years without charge. That's a democracy? It's not. It's like Iran.
What are your thoughts about the governance and division of the city of Jerusalem? How would you see Jerusalem ideally being governed?
It would need to be shared equally. There's no question about that. There needs to be Jewish holy sites, need to be respected for Jews, and Muslim holy sites for Muslims, Christians, etc. So my ideal situation is all the holy sites protected and shared.
We've run out of time and we're running a tight ship here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Signing books at the back of the end, that's it.
This audio is from Radio New Zealand. To find out more, visit radionz.co.nz.